knew you'd have better memories of really this since you were such a young kid. The Milky Bar kid, we used to call it. Anyway, welcome to Prog and Progeny, Eric.
Hello.
Eric Nielsen. As you know, we do this podcast and thought it'd be great to get you on to discuss the period, that terrible period in your life when you worked with Marillion.
It wasn't terrible. It was groundbreaking.
Yeah, we were definitely.
It opened a lot of doors, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, let's quickly do what we normally do with guests is just give us a quick synopsis of what you were doing when we met you. You were in Cleveland, right?
Yeah, I was born and grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Various machinations of schools and universities and that kind of thing. But at the time we got in touch, I was working at a help desk at a university in Cleveland called Case Western Reserve University. But I was also playing in bands. I did stuff on the side, you know, hauling cable for, you know, local arena shows and that kind of thing. I mean, I worked the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony way back when that opened up. Because I was studying, I did a lot of theatre in my youth, but I was working on technical theatre and set construction and lighting design. So I kind of had my fingers in the sort of show, live and touring kind of vibe in there.
Here's a question for you that I don't know the answer to. What the hell were you doing on the Freaks mailing list? Because this is so, Tallulah. He's like, how old were you, like 23 at the time?
Yeah, 22.
No,
I was younger than that. Yeah. It was a woman I was seeing at the time. she said, oh, there's this band, Marillion. And she said, there's this album, Brave. It's really, really good. You should have a listen to it. So I'm like, okay, I'll have a listen to that. And she dragged me along to go see the Afraid of Sunlight tour.
Okay, that was
in, I think it was Columbus,
yeah.
Ohio. Wherever it was the same gig that you guys met Rick Armstrong at. Because I remember going out and going... What?
I think that was Cincinnati.
Yeah?
Yeah, because that's where the Armstrongs are from. So yeah. It probably was Cincinnati.
Anyway, it was her fault, entirely her fault, that I got involved. And so it's like, oh, yeah, this is a pretty good album. So and she said, oh, they do this thing on the internet. And there's like, oh, use groups. And I'm like, oh, I do use groups. I know all of that stuff. I mean, I had my first email address, I think, in 1990.
Right.
Way back. I was very au fait with the internet for quite some
very
time.
Early adopter, yeah. Because I first came across the Freaks mailing list in around about 93 or 4. Yeah. So still fairly early. There was no browsers back then. It was so difficult, wasn't it?
Well, Telnet and
dial-up modems and all that stuff. So anyway, I've told the story many times of how I invited you to come to... You answered my advert for a keyboard tech, and then I said, after chatting with Eric for 15 minutes, I said, come to San Juan Capistrano in California. And then, so how did you break that to your parents?
Oh, they still haven't forgiven me.
Mum and Dad, I'm going to quit my job, and I'm just going to head off to the West Coast and meet up with this rock and roll band.
Yeah, I've dropped quite a few clangers on them over the years, actually, like that. That was basically it, really. A friend of mine at the time, we were sharing a flat in Cleveland, so I didn't give that up, so I was still paying rent on that just in case. I literally just kind of said, this is what I'm going to do. And it's same thing with the people at the university. I said, well, look, I have this opportunity. Is there any chance, kind of hedging my bets, that because you said, oh, this is only till October, it's just a short tour. So I said to them, look, is there any way I could take a hiatus? I might only be out there for 3 days and they'll hate me and I hate it. So that's what's going to happen. But it didn't, obviously.
So you just met via the Freaks mailing list. Did you put an ad out?
Yeah, I was just sort of paying attention and it was this girl, this woman Melanie, who kind of said, "Oh, did you see they're asking for this? They need an American. They need a keyboard tech. You should totally go for that because you play keyboards. Yeah. You know all this. You work in the theater."
It was mostly Americans on the list, which is why I kind of put it out there and said, "We're looking for a keyboard tech for the tour. Does anybody know anybody?" Or is, you know, and probably. There's probably 3 or 4 people said, yeah, I'll do it. And I just did a little phone interview to decide who to choose. And Eric lost, so he got the gig. And that's right. So I remember, so there was a period where you were kind of working for us, trying to do the database stuff, but over the internet, through a dial-up connection and all that.
Well, no, see, this is the benefit, and this is when I went back to the university after that European tour. They were like the first fiber optic internet place in the whole of Cleveland.
Right.
So, and, you know, I'm going to say this now because it's not really going to bother anyone, right? But basically, when people weren't looking, I'd like switch down the database and start programming the Merlin website. Then people kind of like, whoa, boss mode. You know, it's like, oh, here's the database. I'm working on this. The software that we were using at the university was a database called FileMaker. Who Rick Armstrong worked for, and that's where we built the original data system on that, because I had loads of experience in doing that. So I was kind of utilizing Case Western's resources to build the initial Merlin website without their knowledge. You know, hey.
So can you remember what it was that prompted us to say, right, why don't you come and move to the UK and work with us from our kebab hut?
From the way that I recall it and remember it is that throughout that tour, I was just really nosy and I kept asking questions. Like, well, why don't you know, you can do this thing online. And Mark, you had said, oh, we have this website. We have the record fan club CDs that you sold at gigs. And wouldn't it be great to sell it somewhere else? I'm like, well, you can do these websites. You can do that kind of thing online. And I said, well, what happens to all these T-shirts? Where do they go at the end of the tour? Oh, they just go back to a warehouse. You could sell them online, right? And I think you were doing the Positive Light remixes, or then that had just happened.
That was
so like, how can we sell this? And I'm like, well, that's a great thing. You could put that online. And this is before downloads, because we were at, you know, 36K and 56K dial-ups and all that kind of stuff.
This is like the end of 97, early 98.
And then going back to what we were saying just before we started recording this, you showed me the website that you were trying to build. And I thought, oh, God, no, you can't do that. I can help you.
I wish I had a copy of it.
Now, I wish I did. I just remember one of them. You had like Live in Caracas up there, and it was, you know, this is the old HTML 90s days. And the background was like a beach chair and a palm tree by the sea. I was is that supposed to be Caracas? What is that? And it was like my first website. Really, I'm sorry, Mark. Best will in the world. It was terrible.
Okay. Moving on. Nothing to see.
But I really want to see it.
Yeah, I wish I remember. I can see it in my head. Yeah, and that's where I kind of went. You and I were having a chat because you did emails back then and all that kind of stuff. I said, "Well, look, I can do better than this." And what was it? Is it
Bert? He's modest, isn't he?
Bert. Sounds like I could do better than that.
All right.
Yeah, no, carry on.
You're the one in the band. You do the art. I can do that stuff, right? So I had this archive of stuff over a couple of these zip disks that I was using to build up and put a website together, replicating a little bit of the discography just to have here's what you do, and then a lot of the products. And then through that and the people at the help desk learning to program, I think it was Perl scripting at the time, you know, how do you take credit card numbers, how do you generate an order, how do you do all this kind of stuff to be able to automate that process. And then it was...
I can remember, you just reminded me, there was a period where we would take orders from people. This is how unautomated it was. And it was because, you know, we were doing something that people, you know, this whole internet commerce thing was new, wasn't it? You know, so we were taking orders, and then what we'd have to do, we had a credit card machine that you had to type in the credit card number, and then it would print out a receipt, and, you know, you literally...
Oh, my God.
And then I think at one point the credit card company were getting suspicious because we'd be like chucking in thousands of pounds worth of orders in a day, you know, from nowhere. They're like, what's going on here? You know,
because at that time there were like off the shelf kind of software packages that would automate it. But they were like £50,000.
Right.
And that was in the late 90s because no one was doing it. And no one had the facilities, and banks just didn't have that internet thing on, so we had to sort of do it by hand and, you know, take the credit card stuff that way. So that's
and then we got into a real problem because we had all this money that we'd put into the, this was probably a pre-order for an album, but around about the time Michael Jackson died, the credit card companies realized that they'd basically they'd taken all these payments for tickets for Michael Jackson, handed over the money, and then the gig got cancelled, or the gigs, because he was no longer with us. So then they suddenly started up, they tightened up all their rules about credit card payments. And
you couldn't take the payment until...
They wouldn't give us the money until we'd done the gig or shipped the product, which was not our business model at all. Our business model was take the payment and use the money to make the product or to live until we made it. So that was a real problem.
But that Stuart Every, who was the engineer, your engineer at the time and sort of ran the studio, it got to the point where he was packing up stuff with like stamps and taking them down the village post office, and then that started getting too much, and we were having a conversation about taking the index cards of the fan club and transferring them into this database that we had that I'd sort of started building to go, okay,
I can remember doing that as
well. You just put that in, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's the point where I think you said, or I offered, or a combination of the two, it's like, well, wouldn't it be a lot easier if you did this in the UK? So I said yes, and came to live with you, actually.
Yeah.
Very generous.
Me and your mum, actually.
Heard about this, yeah.
Yeah.
Your mum probably said something along the lines of, well, after Eric had been with us for a year, we had to ask him to find somewhere else to live. And Eric was like, well, I was thinking of going anyway. And then,
it was true. It's just that I didn't have any money because he didn't pay very well.
Oh, come on.
But yeah, no, I really was going to move out. I just didn't.
I'm joking. Don't worry. And while Eric lived with us, he taught us how to make jambalaya. That was a great dish, which I've forgotten. He's going to show me again now.
Yeah.
We were talking about
I really want to try jambalaya. I've never tried
it. Yeah, well, you know.
Mine's great.
Like a prawn one or...
And he used to
it's all the meats. It's prawns and chicken like and sausage.
The salad you used to make as well with tuna and celery and cheese and, you know, do you still do that?
Oh, that's just what Americans call tuna salad, yeah.
So that was like 98?
Yeah, the beginning of 98. I think about February. When we came back from the tour, it was, I think I got back in about November, and then I worked over the winter and in about February packed everything up and moved over. And that's where I started. I'd actually brought my computer over from the States that I had because everything was on it. And then that became the Racket business computer.
And then we ended up having to get a porter cabin because the Racket Records business was kind of growing and there was more stuff. And we actually moved Eric out to an office out in this porter cabin, which we affectionately called
the Kebab Hut.
Kebab Hut. Kebab Van 1, and then we had Kebab 2.
Yeah. That was slightly larger and crapper.
But, and then do you remember when Lucy started working for us?
Yes. Yes, because that was sort of just before we had done the whole Marillion.com stuff at that point, so Radiation. And then at that point, that's where we had transferred all the fan club data over. And I suggested that there's a way we should get all this other data, because all the other webs had their various fan clubs. And it's like, well, if we're automating all of this, if we have all this central database and we're selling stuff, shouldn't we match up the customers with the fans and so on and so forth? But they were very reluctant to give away all this stuff that they had collected. And that's how the Christmas CD came about. It was like, if we give you this free thing that has exclusive stuff on it, then, you know, let's share that around. And that's where we consolidated the database. And then Marillion.com happened, where, again, it was very much the mailback cards and let's try and get it in touch with as many humans as possible to bolster this database and build it up in any way we possibly could, with the intention of, well, maybe we can contact these people directly next time or at some point. And that's the point where I said, well, look, I don't have the marketing experience. I can do all this technical background stuff. I can run the website and all of that. But as far as who do I pitch to radio for an album, it's like that was beyond me. And that's where, you know, you were talking with Lucy because she had done all the remasters around that same time at EMI, hadn't she? And that's how you knew her.
Yeah, and then at some point, because we did all the Marillion.com stuff and we were growing the database, we had a, not really a plan, but we were sort of moving towards this independence route, but we didn't know it at that point. Can you remember when I suggested the crowdfunding thing, which wasn't called crowdfunding, but the pre-order, as we called it?
Yeah. I remember it happened.
I remember you were enthusiastic. You loved the idea.
Yeah.
And some people didn't. But what about the rest of the guys? Can you remember what people... You probably can't remember what people said, but...
I remember skepticism. And I remember... I vividly remember this because it happened very quickly, this whole thing. It was kind of like, well, why don't we do this? And there was a lot of back and forth. I remember being in the kitchen at the Racquet Club, and I think I said, well, why don't we just add, we have all this database. And I think at the time it was like 12,000 people, like 10 or 12,000 people. So I said, well, why don't we just send them an email? Ask them. Why don't we see what the fans will do? Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And we set up two new email addresses, yes@marillion.com and no@marillion.com.
Yeah.
And we said, hey, we have this crazy idea. Would you buy an album a year before it was even made? And that was basically that. It wasn't, we'll put your name in the credits, and all deluxe edition, none of that kind of stuff. Is, in theory, would you do this? And I think, you know, we just sat there and...
And we said... Just send the email to yes or no.
No.
Don't reply in the message because we won't read it. We're just going to count the emails. That was the idea, wasn't it?
Within minutes. And by the end of the day, when you had 6,000 yeses in that inbox, even if you multiply that by £10 an album, you kind of go, hang on, right?
And there was, I remember there was about 200 no's.
And then when everyone came back and said yes, it's like, okay, what next now? Okay, that question's answered. That opens up a whole other series of questions there, doesn't it? And what would we do exactly?
How are we going to do this?
How much is it? And that's when everyone was like, okay, how much is this going to cost? How much does Racquet cost to run? How much do we have to pay people? All this kind of stuff started going in. And like, how can we do this? And then the discussions about how can we incentivize this? Well, why would you want to pay up front for it? Do you want something special? And that's where we came up with the names, you know, putting your name in the credit as a thank you and that kind of thing. And then we talked about the deluxe edition and having something different with the idea to still put something in the shop, but we wanted something special for the fans. That...
Which was only for the pre-order people. All this stuff is kind of common.
Well, yeah.
These days, a lot of bands do similar things and have done. But basically that whole, the way of marketing and all that and the crowdfunding thing was brand new. Nobody had done it before, really.
Yeah.
And how much did you make?
We didn't make a great deal. I mean, we made enough money that we could carry on and make another record. That's the truth. I mean, it was...
It said 200 grand in the book.
Well, we did...
Quite possibly. I honestly can't remember.
I remember the fake catalogue number. It wasn't fake catalogue number, but the catalogue number we had intact was the Intact Records, right?
And you know where that came from?
Intact.
Intact.
No.
It was a review. I think it might have been in... It was in Q magazine, and the title of the review was Intact! ! And it was talking about Marillion and how we, you know, we were still going sort of thing.
Right.
You know? I think it was either a review of This Strange Engine or one of our albums, anyway, one of our later albums. And that was, we liked that as a, you know, Intact, we're still going, you know, so that was where we got that from.
But that catalogue number that I used on the artwork, I think it's like 12684 or something like that. That was literally the number of pre-orders of the special edition. Just sort of like a little, this is how many of these were ordered. Obviously, we've sold since then, but at the point...
Yeah, okay. I remember it was close to 13,000.
To answer your question, well, they were £16 each. We sold 12,500 of them. Get a calculator out. I can't do it that quickly.
My mental maths is terrible.
It's £200,000 exactly.
Is it?
Well, wow.
But, of course, there's the outgoing that you have to spend on manufacturing and the artwork. There was some, but even so, when you compare that, let's say we spent 50,000 on the production of the CD. Compare that to the 100,000 advance that we got from Castle for the previous three albums, and you can see it's a step up. We weren't exactly rolling in money, but we were doing better. So it was definitely the way forward.
Mm.
And that doesn't count all the CDs that we then sold through EMI, because once we decided to do the pre-order and it was all going well, we went to EMI and said, we want you to release it to the shops, because we weren't doing that. So they, the mistake we made was we said, we don't want an advance, we just want you to spend money on marketing and get it out there.
And that was sort of one of the first label services deals ever, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the, but by not giving us an advance meant that they really didn't care how many it sold, because they were making money from the start. We should have tried to squeeze them for a few quid and taken a lower royalty, whereas we thought, well, no, we want a high royalty and no advance, which may have been a mistake. Anyway, but yeah, it probably was one. We were quite surprised that they were even willing to entertain the idea. You can see that the that was, and that was very early in the days of Napster and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, the record industry wasn't really suffering yet like it would 5 years or 10 years later.
Had you started writing the album when you did this, or had you not even...
I think we were working on it, but we certainly weren't finished with it. Because I do remember that pressure of thinking,
yeah,
oh my
you'd
God,
think...
people have paid money for this album that we haven't finished. It's like... So, yeah.
But I guess they're paying money for an album they've never heard before anyway. It's not like Spotify now.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. And back then, it's like, well, you had to buy the album when it came out if you wanted to hear it anyway.
Yeah.
There was no other way to hear it, really.
Yeah, apart from piracy.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of the stuff that happened in the studio?
There was something where you and I recorded Steve H's vocal and put it on a Walkman inside a tumble dryer. I think it was These Chains, the end of These Chains. Does that ring a bell?
It does, yes. Yeah, we were quite experimental in this. And what about, oh yeah, there was the tour that we did where we couldn't afford a truck and a tour bus, so we did it all on fly-in and fly-out gigs.
Oh, and that's, yeah.
And we took our gear as luggage, you know,
yeah.
Literally.
We there's that episode, I get that, maybe once a year, where people say, oh, I saw you on some...
Airline,
like, rerun.
Oh, really? Is it still available?
Yeah.
And then you got deported, do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember that. Coming back from Sweden. Excuse me, sir. Because technically, I was a tourist this whole time. Up until that point. And I used to get a renewed visa, because the tourist visas at the time, I think, were 3 months.
3 months, I think, yeah.
So I would just go down to London, hop on Eurostar, travel to Lille in France, get a French passport there, have lunch, get on a train, come back, get a stamp in London for another 3 months.
That sounds really illegal.
Yeah. I got deported.
Not illegal, just like kind of...
No, 100% totally illegal.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, it's lucky that they let you back in. That's because...
Well, you had a lot to do with that, actually, because at that point, they took my passport away from me, they marched me back onto the plane. You and Tallulah, your dad, saved me on that day. If it weren't for him, I probably would have never made it back, because I sold him my keyboard. In fact, I don't know if that's in frame, that keyboard there, right? That's my JP8000. You bought that for me for cash, so that I had money in cash to take with me back home when I got deported, right? Because you're just on the next flight out. Now, thankfully, they knew I had been in and out for a while, so they let me spend the night and collect some luggage and belongings and stuff, and I left most of it behind. They flew me to Philadelphia, which, if you look at a map in Cleveland, Philadelphia, I mean, they ain't close. There's like 1,000 miles in between, right?
No,
with no regard for the fact that how you were going to get home to Cleveland.
Their job is to get me back to America. That's it.
Yeah.
So, thankfully, I had this wad of cash and had to spend most of it on a one-way ticket from Philadelphia to Cleveland. So, talk about bombshells. First of all, hey, Mom and Dad, I'm going to work for this rock band in California. Hey, Mom and Dad, I've been deported. Can I come home tomorrow? Yeah, that was another one.
Well, sorry, Eric, but we've rented out your room. Yeah.
They had. I had to sleep in the basement. Now, thankfully, they had some spare beds. But yeah, no, they had totally converted my room into an office by that point. And I think at the time, because that was 98, so it was still earlier on, and that's where which Sanctuary, they said they had all their visa people and people that sort that kind of thing out. And that's where you put together a case that I got a work visa, so that I was indispensable in the running of this business to as a creative.
That's right. They employed some immigration service to help with the application to get Eric back as on a work visa.
And then the tour then provided an opportunity to get a different type of work visa and then another one. So we kind of overlapped them, but then I started running out of options there. And I nearly got deported a second time coming back from the radiation tour, because I had met this woman and we had been seeing each other for about 6 months. And I said, well, at the end of this tour, I've got no more visas. They don't have any more albums out. There's no more tours coming up. And she kind of went, I'll marry you. And it was going to be totally like the green card. Like, we're going to have to learn, you know, what kind of toothpaste you use. And we lived in separate places, right? And it was our 25th wedding anniversary in December.
Oh,
yeah, I was going to say, say hi to Rachel for me.
But that's then that was around the time of Marbles, and that's when it kind of ramped up. That's when Marbles was, I think, for me the pinnacle of all of that kind of stuff.
That was talking about making money through. That was when we realised actually we were actually making much more money. And enough that we could do marketing and actually have an advertising budget and all those things. You know, we ploughed a lot of the money, but even into some not so clever marketing ideas. Do you remember the Stop. Musical Mystery?
Mm. So Ring this was bell.
So there was a company called 1000 Head. They came up with this suggestion that we did a quiz, and the idea is to identify the band, and then the band is obviously us,
mm-hmm.
and then mm-hmm. people would enter the quiz and we would collect their data and build up this whole you know, just excitement around mm-hmm. this quiz, and the prize was £25,000 of our money.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah. It's ringing a bell now.
Yeah, God knows why, because we had to make the prize big enough that it was going to get publicity and mm-hmm. you know, get some traction, which it did, and the quiz was really good. And you know, we got a lot of people doing it, many of whom weren't Marillion fans, because in fact, the person that actually won this 25 grand was a Spanish woman. No way was she ever going to buy a Marillion album. You know, she was like 57 years old, living in this countryside in Spain. You know, of course it was, she was like made up. You know, so
yeah, you've kind of gone in with the assumption that not enough people know your music, rather than not enough people like your music.
There's a difference, yeah. That's a clear distinction.
So yeah, the Musical Mystery. And in fact, you can go on the Wayback Machine and still find the website, musicalmystery.com. It's still, well, obviously it doesn't exist.
Do you remember
that?
Yeah. So but at that time, that's where we kind of, we became our own sort of merchandisers. We did everything in-house. We would come up with stuff to sell outside of touring.
Some of the stuff we were, again, sailing a bit close. I mean, we like to sail a bit close to the wind, don't we? Do you remember the line of merchandise that we did?
Got some it was the placeholders. Was that for Marbles? All the sort of logo rip-offs and that kind of thing.
We did. We ripped off everybody from Star Wars to Guinness to Carlsberg.
It was Guinness what did us in.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It was so we did, you know, the Carlsberg, they had probably the best lager in the world, right? So I just went into Photoshop and rearranged the letters to make Carlsberg, and it said Marillion instead, right?
Probably the best
band in the world, right? And that was the uncoolest FC UK. That was the FC UK that had their...
got that on my mug.
Yeah,
thing.
That's the one. Yeah. That was ours.
Yeah.
So we did the Star Wars one. We did Guinness. We did... What else did we do?
There was quite a few. Yeah, there was a pint of Guinness, but instead of it saying Guinness, it just said Marillion. So Freya, my daughter, my oldest daughter, she was working for Diageo. She got a letter or an email from somebody basically saying, Marillion are ripping off your logo. And so she calls me up and goes, Dad, what shall I do? I'm like,
such a conflict.
Well, if you can just put it to the... I said, you can't really just get rid of it. Put it to the bottom of the pile, you know. And then it kind of went a bit wrong, because I told Lucy about it and she knew who the person was, recognized the name, and messaged him and said, "What are you doing?" You know, and then he was very upset about the fact that we knew that he was being, you know, basically being horrible to us. He then sends another message to Diageo saying, "Why did you tell Marillion?" Like, as in, this is terrible. Anyway, in the end, we persuaded the guy to just drop the whole thing, and then Freya just buried the the emails, and that was the end of it. And we stopped using their logo, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, good idea in theory. We had a lot of good ideas in theory. Do you remember the marbles? We had this genius idea, and everyone thought it was a great idea. So Marbles was the double album, and you could only buy the double album from us, and retail never liked a double CD because it was have to be more expensive and all that. So the idea was, okay, you create a stripped down one CD version. I think Ocean Cloud was off of it, and something else. You used to have these things called mailback cards, and they would usually be the shape of a CD, and it would be where the CD would go, because most of the high street retailers would take the discs out and you'd go up to the counter and they'd put the disc in for you. But the mailback cards were sort of like what we were doing with Marillion.com, and that's where that came from. Oh, to join up the fan club list, you know, fill out this postcard and send it back. Except in our wisdom, the thing that we decided to say on the mailback card for Marbles was, "Stop! You should have two CDs!" And the idea was, no, buy this album and then use this card and you pay a fiver to get the full two CD version, and then we'll have you on our database. So that was the genius idea we had to capture this. It's like, okay, that'll get their attention. If they're a casual fan who don't know about the website, hey, there's a bunch of new music that you can grab hold of. Except, and I remember it was Virgin Megastores, when they started taking the discs out and putting them behind the counter, there was this card that just said, "Stop." Basically, they thought it said, "Don't buy this album, go to the website." So basically, Virgin Megastores refused to stock the CD because it was telling people to go somewhere else to buy it. Until we had to ship all of them back to the warehouse to get the cards taken out by hand and then ship back to Virgin Megastores.
Oh, God.
Well, I do remember that was the with .com, not having an insert and having it as part of the artwork was the reason, because we knew that stores were already kind of getting annoyed about the fact that people were going direct and record companies were starting to try and, you know, sell direct to fans and bypass the retailers. So they would pull out the cards, like, you know, if they saw a mailback card, they would just take it out and throw it away. Right. So why did you leave us?
I can't what tell you mean? That we're recording.
It just had enough.
Yeah. I think Mark knows. But
When did you leave?
It was, I think, 2008, 2009, somewhere around there. It was one of the big Marillion weekends, and I said, well, that's for me, that's going to be the last thing I do. And obviously, I'll be available here. You know, on and off. And I think I did a couple of months kind of winding down just to, because it was Simon that started working for you then and Colin was still with you, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was around then. One of the main reasons, though, was that I had started going, because Lucy didn't want to be a public face. And people, industry bodies, there's one called AIM, the Association of Independent Music, that we were members of because we were an independent record label, and people were starting to get interested about the story. You know, how did this happen? How did you make it work? And I know you did some of these, H did some of them, you know, but they wanted to talk about this more businessy side of things, and Lucy just didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I'm like, well, I can go. I know how all this stuff works, and have a chat about these things. So I started talking there, and people, you know, would come up and ask questions about it, and because it was still, even in 2007, 2008, really groundbreaking, because that was, Spotify wasn't even there yet. Social media was basically just MySpace, and Facebook had just started showing up. So it was still in the depths of the download nightmares and piracy. And there was a company that we tried, was it Whatever Is Wrong With You, the Music Glue, was that them? you know,
they're still going.
Yeah, get the download. Mark, so it was this Mark sort of, we started reaching out to more industry people that were on the techie side of things that had seen what we'd done and were really interested in that. And that was sort of my, what I did a lot was more the techie side of things.
We went through all that crazy time of giving our music away for nothing. And, you know, do you remember all that? You know, there was just like...
So through that, I was introduced to a lot more people, and a friend of mine that I had met through one of these things happened to work for a company called Rocket Music, which is Elton John's management company. And they were in a meeting one day, and he was talking about, oh, doing that kind of thing that Marillion did. And she kind of went, I know a guy. And so they brought me in, and I had a chat with Elton and his team, and that was that, really. They
poached you, basically. Yeah, this is what I was getting to. Yeah.
To be fair, he left for Elton John. I don't blame him.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Obviously, the next step after Marillion is Elton John.
Is Elton John.
Yeah. Do you want to work in a nice office with Elton, or do you want to stay in the kebab hut?
We had the office by then, though. We had the other...
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah. We'd started the land...
Oh, they'd given you an office. That's
units.
Good.
Yeah.
We've kind of expanded the Racket Club to have more buildings. Yeah. Okay, yeah, but you basically made a name for yourself on after doing the Marillion stuff and you know, became a person that people would go to to find out about all the stuff that we did.
Yeah.
And, you know, your music manager's forum stuff and...
Is early on, because it was still at that cusp of things, then once I was at Rocket, then they would send me to places to sort of be a representative of Rocket and say, hey, we're at the cutting edge and all that kind of stuff. And... there used to be a conference called In the City up in Manchester.
I remember, yeah.
And I was up at that some seminar, and they were talking about some crowdfunding and how they did this, and I was in the audience. I just kind of shouted at one point, no, you've got it all wrong. That's not how you do it. And they went, well, who are you to talk? I'm like, I'm the guy who did all the Marillion stuff. And they went, okay. And they basically pulled up a chair and they got me on the panel.
Right.
And from that, I got to meet a lot of other people, and then I started doing the sort of conferences and that kind of thing, because we were doing a very similar thing with Elton and his ticketing and fan clubs. They already sort of had that in place, but one of the things that I did was sort of bring the social media stuff into it. But it wasn't just for him. I worked at everyone at that company.
So bring us up to date. What do you do these days?
Well, sort of the same thing. So all of that, I've kind of gone into the, you know, assisting managers. I say I'm a professional hole filler, you know, the stuff that needs doing. So a lot of the stuff I do these days tends to be on the marketing side of things. I'm literally just now waiting for a WhatsApp message to get some messaging out for Squeeze on their new album release. I do a lot of e-commerce stuff, you know, setting that kind of thing up. Basically, there's you know, art and fans, right? And that's the music industry. And that bit in between, the business bit, which is what I did for Marillion, really, because Lucy was mainly the markety side of things, and you did the art and the music side of things, but I kind of did the back-endy office stuff, and that's what I've continued to do for a lot of these. You know, I run online advertising campaigns, and because what we did with Marillion, what we collectively did, was no one had done that before, but now, like, every artist ever is just expected to do all of it. That has become the baseline for entering the music industry, is that stuff that was quote-unquote groundbreaking so long ago. It is now a requirement, and so many people just don't have that knowledge or experience. So it's that kind of knowledge that I've just built up over the years of all this different stuff.
Years of experience, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about... Just before you go, now you're not concerned about AI in music and AI in everything, but
I think we're in the .com bubble version of AI, where no one is quite sure how it's working or what it's going to do, and you're already seeing the backlash. Where I think it was last week, Apple decided to label anything that was AI. Deezer's been doing that for a while. People are backlashing. Now, I do some lecturing at BIM University, and one of the courses I run is an entrepreneur course about come up with a new business. And it's interesting, in several occasions for songwriters or producers or those kind of students, one of their selling points that they always want to highlight in their business plan is, we don't use AI. This is like the human, that's the benefit. So when you see that sentiment starting permeating the culture of music, yes, it will have uses if you want background music on a garden TV show, you know, library kind of stuff. It's been used like that for a long time. But I think for other creative endeavors, we're not quite sure. I don't think anyone's sure, and that's the thing, is we can't really guess. But just seeing that sentiment arising suggests that, you know, in the same way, oh, downloading is going to kill music. Yeah, in the same way cassettes are going to kill music, in the same way that all these other things. They all have an impact. Of course they have an impact. But there's probably the other thing that we haven't figured out, because let's solve piracy. Oh, here's streaming music. Yay, it solved it. Hang on. It's something that we never predicted. You know, I was trial by fire, and you kind of just, I didn't know how to do a lot of stuff. So you just ask, how does that work? What about this? And because we were at the beginning of so many things, no one else knew how to do it. So you kind of made it up as you go along, not because you didn't know what you're doing, just because no one had done it.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, to sort of come out the other end of that, I've only been to one Marillion show since I stopped working for you, and that was in Oxford. I wanted to come to the Albert Hall show, and having seen the Blu-ray of it, I'm gutted I didn't. but I remember the discussions the whole time I worked with you. Oh, we want to play the Albert Hall, we want to play the Albert Hall. And it was just sort of, as soon as you announced those dates, I was like, yep. The period that I worked for you, I think we sustained that. And then as the music industry changed and as we entered this new streaming era, you have maintained that, and now you're at that sustainable point for yourselves as well.
Yeah, you started working for us when we were at our commercial low point, really, in terms of the band's career and where we were. And you know, you were part of that transition for us coming out of that and becoming a viable business again.
Do you think crowdfunding saved your career?
Definitely. Yeah, it would have been. I'm not saying we would have stopped making music completely or stopped being a band, but we certainly would have had to get jobs and do something else, and then it would have been a part-time thing, which a lot of people do, you know. But whether or not we would have continued, it's hard to say. But we certainly couldn't have continued as we are now. God, the idea of getting a job. Well, it's horrible, we've all said for years we're completely unemployable, you know. So, right, and on that note, let's end.
Well, that was really good. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.
I've got my thing through, so I can send my Squeeze emails now. We're streams the new Squeeze album. It's called Trixies. A couple more places. It couldn't hurt.
Okay. Really, yeah. I'll check it out. Yeah. Right. Thanks, Eric. Take care.